You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey everyone, welcome to Page to Stage,
a conversation with theater makers.
We're your hosts.
That's Brian.
And that's Mary.
Join us as we focus the spotlight back on the theater maker to uncover their process.
We speak with folks in the industry that often aren't heard from,
such as stage managers, producers, crew members, marketing professionals,
and everything in between. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hi, my name is David Loud, and I am a Broadway music director.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I just want to say, before we really jump into things, so it is an honor to have you with us, and it's because Brian and I met working for Broadway Teachers Workshop, which is where do these beautiful arrangements and for the attendees, the teachers who attend those workshops every year. And for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, basically what David does is he takes a composer or a lyricist and puts together, how long would you say it is? Like 10 minutes? No, it has to be more than 10 minutes, right?
Usually about
like
40?
An hour.
An hour, yeah.
And just talks about their life and what they were doing. And I know that it is it's probably one of the most favorite pieces from all the attendees, but it's definitely before Brian and I, when we were working there, just it was always so exciting to see which person you were going to be, you know, talking about next year after year.
Yeah, the summer that I worked there, you did the Sondheim.
Oh, the Sondheim Prince collaboration? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And that was really, really great.
That was it a was complex great. One.
Yeah.
I imagine. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things in the world to do. And those lectures I also give to my students at Manhattan School of Music, where I teach now. And I love illustrating the points I'm making with the actual songs and having Broadway singers sing them. And try to keep it as fresh and interesting as possible. But that's one of my favorite things in the world to do.
In that particular presentation, you showed pictures of yourself in Merrily We Roll Along, where you began your career.
That's right.
You talked about how, you know, the production wasn't originally a critical success. So I'm wondering if we could begin our conversation by, since that was one of your first, that was your first professional gig.
Yes, absolutely.
What was it like beginning your career with that sort of experience? And then how did that shape what followed?
Well, I have to say, I recommend starting with a huge flop. it was a terrible thing to go through at the time. It was very disappointing and difficult. But in retrospect, I now appreciate when I have success in the theater so much more. And I don't take it for granted. And I think knowing how painful it can be when a show doesn't work and closes before you thought it would, and your new show business family that you've found is dissipated and you'll never see them again sometimes, that was a devastating thing to go through. And that you have to know that that happens in the business, I think. This business is tough. We were always told when I was growing up, you know, don't go into the theater unless you absolutely have to. And I don't think that actually scares anybody away, because people who want it really want it. You can tell them how terrible it is over and over and over, and they still just want it. In retrospect, it was a healthy thing to start with a big flop.
And so that was in your performing days. When did you make the transition to behind the piano?
Well, it was really in Merrily that I was having a great time up on stage, singing and dancing, but it was clear to me, looking around at the talents of the other people in that company, that I didn't have everything that I needed to be a professional actor in musical theater. You know, there's Liz Calloway on my left singing songs like in that angelic voice of hers with no break anywhere. You know, actors like Lonnie Price, Terry Finn, Jim Walton, who were just so skilled. And that wasn't me. But the music director of Merrily We Roll Along was Paul Gemignani, one of the great sort of statesmen of Broadway music directors. And he had such a force and such a command from his spot on the podium. He sort of taught us how to follow a conductor just through the magnetism of his personality. We couldn't take our eyes off him, which is the point. You know, you must always be aware of the conductor if you are in a musical. And he taught us that. We didn't know. We were so young. We were all teenagers in that cast. After Merrily closed, I thought, you know what? I want to be Paul Gemignani when I grow up. And so I stopped pursuing, hadn't really been pursuing a career as an actor. It was a fluke that I was in Merrily. But then I started pursuing jobs as the music director, assistant music director.
What did those early days of pursuing a career in that look like? You were already in the industry in a way, but it was now this completely different way that people had to see you.
That's right. That's right.
And that's always really tough.
If you are a musician, you know, a musical theater musician, you can make a living in the business as an audition pianist, as a coach for actors and singers and dancers. What I really wanted to do was be working on shows. So I was always trying to, you know, find conductors to assist or small enough theaters that would hire somebody without too much experience like me. I did Non-Equity Summer Stock one summer as the assistant music director and got to learn 12 shows doing that. And then they asked me to come back as music director the next summer. I got to learn another 24 shows, and another 12 shows that second summer. And so I just kind of taught myself the things that I needed to know to be a music director. And I was lucky enough to work for some very skillful conductors and music directors that were exciting to learn from.
So it sounds like it was really like you were kind of learning as you go and figuring out like what the quote unquote like right step would be just by doing the
thing. Absolutely. I mean, that when I came to New York, Merrily was in 1981. I was 19 when we went into rehearsals, and I don't think anybody from that cast had gone to a conservatory the way most of the kids who come to be on Broadway now. They've done a four-year program at Cincinnati or Carnegie Mellon or different conservatories. We just came and hung out and tried to figure out what the theater was and how you got a job, and you talked to your friends, and there was more of sort of an oral tradition of people learning the business from each other rather than being taught in a class how to have their audition books look perfect and pristine. And it was a little rougher tumble time back then. But yes, I just have to figure it out by myself.
I love that. I feel like there are, just with the nature of our podcast, we hear a lot of people's origin stories and how, you know, what inspired them to get going. And I feel like a common thread, Brian, I think you would agree, is that people often don't know what they're doing when they're doing it. They really just figure it out. You know, they'll make mistakes along the way. But I think that's so special, because everyone, that really makes everyone's journey that much more unique and that much more rewarding, I think. So I'm curious. So a lot of the musicals that you have music directed are really rich in the storytelling through the song. How much of your role as a music director is also an acting coach, would you say?
It's one of my favorite parts of being a music director, is working with actors on how to interpret the song. And I firmly believe that the music director has a place in that conversation. It's not just between the actor and the director, how they're gonna sing the song. I think the music director is gonna be part of that discussion. When I teach a song, I try to teach it from the point of view of the character that we're trying to create here. You know, it's not just about learning notes. It's about, how would this character sing this phrase? How does this lyric reflect what the character's going through, and what do we need to bring out? What's important to emphasize? It's really my favorite part of working in musical theater, is making a song live and realizing what a composer has created with the instrument that we have in front of us, which in this case is an actor. The music director on a Broadway show is responsible for every piece of music that happens in the show. I attend all the auditions, and I make sure that the voices that are hired are appropriate for this, whatever the musical is, whether it's an operetta and needs, you know, six sopranos who can sing high C's, or if it's a pop show and they have to be able to belt up to a D or a D flat, whatever it's going to be. I'm the person who says, that actor has a perfect voice for this show, or I don't think she's really right for this. You know, she won't be helping us. Then I teach the music and work with the director on how music is going to function in the show. You know, is there going to be underscoring in this scene? How are we going to get into this song? Are we going to blare in or sneak in? Or there's many different ways that dialogue can become song. And that's always my job.
At what point are you being brought on as a music director to work on a production? And who are you being brought on by?
Usually in the developmental stage, that, you know, there's a team of writers. They want to do a reading of their show. So a producer say a 2-week reading of a show. Well, depending on the composing team, sometimes I'll work on the arrangements. You know, sometimes if they're full service, if they, you know, write complete accompaniments and vocal arrangements, then my job becomes simpler. But often I am working with the writing team on the arrangements as well. I'm not there when they're having the original ideas, you know, for how to create the songs themselves, but I'm there usually for the first time they're read out loud by professional actors. And most shows go through a series of readings and workshops, and then maybe an out-of-town tryout. And if they're lucky, you know, 6 years later, maybe you get to Broadway.
During the show's development process as a music director, it seems like you influence the score that maybe will eventually become published or used in subsequent productions. Can you give us examples of maybe something that has come to fruition based on your input in the room?
Sure. The Well, as I said, it depends on who I'm working with. When I work with Lynn Ahrens and Steve Flaherty on Ragtime, they write everything that they want into the score. There are, you know, the vocal arrangements are all worked out, what the chorus is going to sing. Dialogue is usually timed to the music already. They're very precise and clear about what they want. I've done a number of shows with John Kander and Fred Ebb, and more recently just with John Kander because Fred died a couple of years ago. But working with them is very different because John Kander will write a vamp and a melody and hand the song over to me, and I'll figure out how it's going to work in the show, and we're going to start with a chorus, and then we'll maybe modulate here because that'll be better for the leading man, and I'll be structuring the numbers in consultation with John always, but there's much more of my creative work in a score like that. We did The Visit together, and we did The Scottsboro Boys together with Kander, and A Steel Pier on Broadway, and Curtains on Broadway. And my imprint is large in those shows, just in terms of the vocal arrangement and the structure of how the songs are used theatrically.
So I'm imagining with the theater makers who you're working with show after show, year after year, you develop a kind of shorthand with each other. So I'm curious as to how that shorthand really helps embellish each next project. Is it helping you get to the point faster that you're trying to make? Does it make it richer? Is the experience just easier overall? Like what do you see that shorthand doing for you there?
Well, people in the theater like to work with people they know. And it makes sense. I mean, that first day of rehearsal, when you look around the room and you don't know people, and you might be together for the next 2 years, if you're lucky. It's very comforting to be working with people who you know how they work, you know their language, their taste. I would say that it takes a long time to be able to read someone's mind and know, this is the kind of embellishment that John Kander would like. It took me a long time to figure that out. And I know now, pretty much always how to do work that, he's going to approve. And he always has his contributions, which are always breathtaking and wonderful. Having done as many shows as we have together, I do feel like I know his taste, and it does help. Interesting. We are the music directors, really are the collaborators. We're collaborator central. We have to work with the director. We have to work with the choreographer. We have to work with the composer. Sometimes we're working with the set designer, making sure that the music is going to exactly fit the set changes. So the scenery comes in and stops right as the music goes ding, and then everything looks great. Sometimes we'll work with the costume designer and we'll time how long the costume change is. It's going to be 17 seconds. We have to get 17 seconds of music in here and then make sure that it's 17 seconds every night so that the actor can make the costume change. We have our fingers, hopefully, in every little pie that's going around the theater. The better you know the people you're working with, the easier that all that collaboration becomes.
In addition to music directing, you're also an arranger. And as the vocal and dance arranger, you've created so many arrangements over the years, including The Visit, Scottsboro Boys, Sondheim on Sondheim. Can you share with our listeners what an arranger does? And then is that in line with what an orchestrator does? And maybe where do those two cross paths? And maybe where do those two differ?
That's a great question, because people don't really know often what the difference is between those jobs. The arranger, when you arrange music, you're figuring out the style and the way a melody is going to develop. Maybe you're working out what a group of backup girls is going to sing, if that's how it's structured. Maybe you're working out what a chorus will do. Maybe you're working out harmony between the leading man and the leading lady. And you work with what they're going to sing and how they're going to find their notes and what the harmonic lines are going to be. And then that gets written down, usually as a piano vocal, you know, the piano part with the vocal lines on top of it. And an orchestrator then looks at that arrangement, looks at the piano part, and figures out how to translate it to, say, a 19-piece orchestra. Who's going to play this note? And who's going to play this note? And are we going to have lots of strings, or is it going to be mostly brass, or do we need lots of woodwind colors? You know, choosing the palette that the orchestra is going to paint with. But the orchestrator is the person who translates the piano part into what 19 people say are going to play. And orchestrators on Broadway shows have to work incredibly fast, because often work is not done on the musical numbers until well into rehearsals. And it all has to be done before the first preview. And you try to bring the orchestrators in to see the numbers once they're choreographed so that the orchestration can match the choreography. It's a real sort of a death race at the end of rehearsals, trying to get ready for that first orchestra rehearsal.
I love that visual. It's very helpful. I never thought about it like that, but I mean, I definitely didn't realize that orchestrators have a very limited window of time.
You could orchestrate a show before rehearsal started, but everything would change in rehearsal. You just have to redo the whole thing.
I'm curious to what your specific process is. Are you looking at a individual song at a time and arranging from there? Or are you looking at the whole show and kind of figuring out if there any kind of theme, or like looking at like a start to finish? Look at like kind
it
of like an outside perspective.
On the show that I'm working on. You know, if I'm working on a Broadway show that has a story and development and characters that, you know, that have to be expressed in a certain way, then really it's about the text and figuring out how the song is going to function in the show, what the director needs, what the choreographer needs. You know, is the chorus available to be in the number if there's going to be a lot of vocal work? If I'm doing a show that is just more like a musical concert, where I'm, say, creating an evening of arrangements of songs by Burton Lane, you know, who wrote Finian's Rainbow and On a Clear Day, You Can See Forever, then I'm writing with a very different goal, which is I want to present his music as faithfully and beautifully and creatively as I can. Finding the line between doing exactly what he wrote and also putting my touches on it, which hopefully are designed to freshen up something if we've heard it too many times, and also make it as appealing as possible to the ears of today.
I'm going to recall that Sondheim Prince presentation you did at Broadway Teachers Workshop, but I still tell people about the arrangement you did of Broadway Baby. I loved it. It was haunting. It was a beautiful, beautiful arrangement.
Thank you. I sort of slowed it down a little bit and took a little of the sort of old woman gusto, which is traditional in that song, out of it and turned it into almost sort of a scared little lullaby of sort of wondering about the business. And yeah, thank you for mentioning that. That was a fun one. I was pleased with the way it came out.
Yeah. So you've worked with some brilliant and legendary people in the theater industry, you know, real titans of the theater. How do you develop your own unique process when you're working with such great people that I'm sure you want to, you know, pick and choose from everybody, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love to learn, and I love to be educated in how something could be done better if I have a certain way of doing it. I got to work with Sondheim several times over the course of my time working on Broadway, you know, first as a teenager And then later as the music director, and then on Sondheim and Sondheim as a, I mean, I really arranged a lot of the material that we presented in that show. I mean, I would have thought that he would have been terrified to have one of the Merrily kids suddenly music directing his work. But he was so kind and so excited and sort of open to the to my input and collaboration. It really floored me how graciously he allowed me to make that transition.
That's got to be surreal, full circle for you.
Yeah.
To have started your career like that and, you know, in what your career had blossomed into becoming, then working with him again in that way.
In that, so intimately. Different capacities, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And being able to see from two perspectives just got to be so interesting.
He is one of the heroes of my life, and he's a hero who never disappointed me on any level, not artistically, never personally. He was always so kind and so supportive. I've never heard a note of his that disappoints.
And I think I always laugh when people say, like, you know, don't meet your heroes. But honestly, like,
well, if they're like Steve,
it's the most rewarding.
You should
experience.
Try to meet them. But there aren't many like that. I mean, I put him up there with Mozart, Michelangelo, and Shakespeare. I mean, this is a man that you can learn about life from if you look at his lyrics. I think he taught me how to be an adult reading his musicals. And think of the way in Company he defines marriage as having two contradictory thoughts at the same time. You're sorry grateful, you're regretful happy. And that is so profound and interesting and something to learn from. And I think of lyrics like in Sweeney Todd, when she says, a seaside wedding could be devised, me rumpled bedding legitimized. And you suddenly know, oh, they're sleeping together. Even though they're not behaving in the play like they're sleeping together, that lyric gives us that little fact that they've slept together already. And I don't know, I think he is as great a playwright as he was a composer and a lyricist.
I love that. I am such a huge fan of Sondheim, and so I love that tidbit. Thank you for sharing that with us. I'm curious, based on all the shows you worked on over the years, what do you have a particular favorite genre that you like working in, or a genre of music that you really lean in towards?
When I was a kid, and you hear this over and over from people, I listened to the record collection that my parents had in the living room of My Fair Lady and Guys and Dolls and Bells Are Ringing and West Side Story and the great Broadway musicals that most middle-class families had recordings of. And that's the music that I long to work on. I love working on that music. And that's not really where Broadway is anymore, which is frustrating for me and disappointing occasionally. But I would say that working on a show like Ragtime, you know, certainly satisfied that itch of mine. And composers like, I mean, I'm so lucky to work with teams like Bach and Harnack on the She Loves Me revival and Kandereb and Sondheim, who are writing in that tradition, if not in that exact kind of way. But that's where my heart lives. I mean, I'll do a pop musical if you force me to, but I'm probably not your best choice for that job.
Amazing. I wanted to talk a little bit about your memoir that came out earlier this year, just even last month.
It came out yesterday, actually.
It came out yesterday. Yeah. Okay, maybe it went on pre-sale in February then.
Yes, it did.
So it's called Facing the Music, and it is what you call a Broadway memoir. And when I read the prelude, I was immediately hooked.
Oh,
that
good.
Story had my heart.
It's quite a story.
I was like, well, this is totally a theater. I mean, yes, it was obviously a Broadway story, but I think anyone who's ever worked in theater, Broadway or not, can relate to that like heart racing moment where you can't find your score.
It was a terrible night.
Oh my gosh. So I really appreciated that as just like the jump right into this memoir. And so I'm curious as to what was it like putting, you know, pen to paper, so to speak, in sharing your story in this medium?
It was hard. I wasn't in that practice of sitting down every morning and writing and seeing what came out and then rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. I just, it took me 6.5 years. I had given a little commencement address up at a school, and this woman came up to me after the speech and said, "I think this could be a book." And I thought that was very nice. And I went on to the next person who wanted to say something nice to me. But that woman went and found my husband and said to Pedro, "David didn't take me very seriously, but I am a New York publisher, and I really think he should make this into a book, and I will publish it." And so Pedro convinced me to call her, and I went and met her in her very nice downtown chic office, and all of a sudden I was writing a book for the next 6.5 years. And she published it after all of that. I mean, it was such a wonderful way to write a first book with that kind of confidence. She wasn't going to publish it until it was good, so it did take a long time. And she found me a great editor, and she gave me the title. I'd been calling it A View from the Pit, which I thought was very nice and clever, but Facing the Music ultimately turned out to be a more perfect title for it.
And how, I'm sure, very surreal to be working on it in what ended up being its final drafts over the last 2 years when theater was at a standstill.
And we all hungered for it so much in that time. And you'd get little glimpses of it, you know, in those terrible Zoom musicals that we pretended that we liked for a while, and people missed it so much. And we didn't know. I mean, who knew before the pandemic that having a singer sing at a piano with you live was the most precious thing in the world? I mean, I knew it was the most precious thing in the world, but I so took it for granted. And to have it taken away for so long was just awful.
And so was writing your memoir during those last 2 years. Did it make it more special? Were you able to really like dive in deeper with what you were writing?
It did give me a lot of time, which was nice.
Yeah.
By then I was really rewriting. I had written a much different book to start, much longer. And Judith, who published it, Judith Regan, she said, "You're hiding on every page." And I took those notes and did a rewrite and then handed it in thinking I'd get A plus 100, and it came back with like 500 more questions. So I wrote, and I got upset then, and I threw the book into the bottom of my closet and didn't look at it for a couple months. And then I picked it up again and thought, oh, these questions are quite extraordinary. And I rewrote it a third time, and that was sort of during the pandemic. And the questions were, you know, what did you feel about this? How did this affect you? What was your reaction when this person said this? And that was hard work to dig up the truth of putting my emotions into all the stories I was telling. And then I started paring it down to a much more focused book and kind of discovered what the book needed to be. It was a difficult process, but ultimately, I'm very, very proud of the way it turned out, and it's certainly more than it would have been without the help that they gave me.
And what do you hope people take away from your story? And just like Mary said, that even if you're not a theater person, you'll be able to relate.
Well, I think any story, if it's true and specific, is universal. We can find ourselves in anybody's story, I think. You find things that they feel that you felt. And if you keep it specific and truthful, then I think anybody can see themselves in it and sympathize and hopefully learn, you know, the little lessons I've learned myself and just living life and having challenges, you know, health challenges or emotional challenges. I mean, I always think of Sheldon Harnick, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof. He wrote the lyrics for Fiddler on the Roof, and they did Fiddler in China. And he went to see the opening in China, and the guy came up to him and said, how did you write a musical that was so Chinese? You know, this is Fiddler on the Roof, the most Jewish, un-Chinese musical ever written. But because it was so specific, you know, people in an opposite culture could see completely their own stories up on stage there.
That's fascinating.
Some of the reactions that I've been getting, you know, that people have been reading the book, it's such a compliment, but people have said to me, when you're telling your stories, it feels like you're telling my story in a way. And that's such a compliment.
It's exactly what, or at least what it seemed like we admire about Sondheim's work, or the great composers, the great, you know, playwrights,
right.
When they tell a story that is so impactful or holding up that mirror, it's not us on stage. We're not those characters, but it's still so resonant.
I'm learning that is true. Yeah.
Well, we're going to put the link to your book in our show notes for our listeners who want to have a little bit of a deeper dive into the life of David Loud.
That's terrific. Thank you.
Mary, would you like to move into our lightning round portion?
Yes, let's do it. David, what is one thing in the theater industry that confuses you?
Why jukebox musicals are popular. I do not enjoy them.
What are three adjectives that describe your ideal working environment?
Supportive, quiet, and with good acoustics. I don't think that's an adjective.
That's all right. Is there something in your process that you find unique to you?
I do find that when I make those big arrangements where I'm putting three different songs together and weaving them together, I can go into that process without knowing where I'm going. And the music leads me to the end, generally. It always feels like a big risk to me to do that. And I think, well, why? Maybe I should plan it out this time. But then I usually don't, and it always works out.
I know we're not responding to these answers, but I will just say what you just said there very much reminded me of the story you tell in your book about, and really ultimately what you had to do for the first several, maybe half of the show, where you had to, you know, conduct blindly,
right.
And you're just, you know, literally following your heart and following, you know, trusting yourself and just kind of letting that take the lead.
Are there any books or resources that you find helpful to you in your process?
Well, one of my favorite books in the world is Act One by Mozart. It's a book that you should keep away from children who you don't want to turn into, you know, carnies and circus people. It makes you want to go into the theater. And it made me want to go to the theater, and I've read it many times, and I make all my students read it, and I made anyone I ever dated in my entire life read it. And there are other books like that I love. Alan J. Lerner's On the Street Where I Live is a great book to read. Ted Chapin's book, Everything Was Possible, that he wrote about when he was an intern at Follies, is a magical book and very interesting. Jack Vertel's book, Secrets of the Broadway Musical, is quite helpful in giving us and my students, I teach it in my history course, just a language to use when talking about how musicals are structured. You know, knowing what an I Want song is, what a conditional love song is, things like that.
What is one job in the theater industry that you would trade jobs with for 1 week?
Well, that would be fascinating. I'd love to be a director for a week. Be in charge. Absolutely. Very fun.
What's one hobby that you have outside of theater?
I have to do a lot outside theater. But I do love to walk. I don't really have a hobby outside the theater, I would say. I have all my eggs in one basket.
Easy. There you go. Okay, great. And our final question for today is, what's the last great piece of theater that you saw?
When I think of like the great theater that I've seen, it's the theater that I get lost in. That's what I pray for when I go to a show, to lose myself for 2.5 hours and go there, go somewhere else. And it doesn't happen very often. The most recent musical that did that for me reliably, it was A Light in the Piazza at Lincoln Center Theater by Adam Gettle with Victoria Clark, who is an old friend of mine. Her performance as Margaret and that just was the most magical thing in the world. And when I would watch A Light in the Piazza, I would get very tense about 20 minutes in because I would think, when can I see it again? I have to see it again. And I would calm myself down saying, you can buy a ticket, you can see it again. And then I could relax and watch the show.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. This was an excellent conversation.
Oh, what a pleasure to talk to you guys.
And where can our listeners find you and your book?
Facing the Music is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I'm sure any place that fine books are sold. And it's called Facing the Music by David Loud. It's a Broadway memoir. And it came out yesterday, which was Stephen Sondheim's birthday. I thought that was a very good omen. And I hope you like it if you buy it.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, David. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Page to Stage. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Page to Stage Podcast.
And if you're enjoying these conversations, we would really appreciate it if you could take a couple minutes to rate and review us wherever you're listening to this podcast. Until next time.
That's Brian.
That's Mary.
We'll see you later.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.